We would like to acknowledge that the land on which CITR operates and broadcast, and where many of you are listening to the program from, is the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people.
Hello and welcome to That Song from That Movie. I'm Movie Maverick Mike.
And I'm Logan the Extra. Today we're talking about That Thing You Do and its eponymous song.
To call the movie That Thing You Do, this biographical comedy directed by Tom Hanks, calling it genteel and pleasant is doing it a disservice. Like the plot of the movie, where a 1960s pop band rockets to success in the Midwest, the movie leans into nostalgia and American iconography, making for a cinematic experience that's squeaky clean and gee whiz fun. But the movie does have some surprising depth and insightful musical moments, including the title song, which propels the band and the movie to its bittersweet conclusion.
Are you someone in recovery? Someone struggling with addiction or disordered eating? Or are you simply curious to explore your relationship to alcohol, drugs, and other types of addictive behaviors? The UBC Student Recovery Community is a safe space to connect with others. The SRC provides many types of support, such as drop-in hours, recovery meetings, one-on-one support, and even has a dedicated recovery lounge. The SRC supports all pathways of recovery, from harm reduction to abstinence and everything in between. You can learn more at recovery_UBC on Instagram. And you can also contact the community at src.recovery@ubc.ca. Remember, you're not alone.
You're listening to Movie Maverick Mike and Logan the Extra on CITR 101.9 FM, UBC, Vancouver, British Columbia. So Logan, this is a movie I really enjoyed. I think it's an underrated movie. What did you think of it?
I agree. It's not, I wouldn't put it in my top 10 movies, but I think it's a movie that, you know, anyone could enjoy. Like you said, it's a feel-good movie. And as we'll get into later, there's no real villain. It's just a bunch of people just, you know, having fun, being in a band.
It's hard to praise this movie without making it feel bigger than it is, because, like, I'm proud of myself for using the word genteel, and it has a pleasant experience. There's no antagonist, like you alluded to. There's no bad guy. There's no great villain or horrible thing to overcome.
Yeah, you're not going to walk away from this movie and say, you know what, I've gained a deeper insight on life as a whole, or it's not going to change your life by any means, but you know, it's fun to watch.
It's not just a slice of life movie, because the movie, as is typical for our show, we assume you've seen the movie or at least knowledgeable of it. The movie kind of moves forward from the pop band, from they're stumbling together as a group, forming together, to all the way to pop stardom. The movie, they call themselves the band, they'll call themselves the Wonders, so it's an obvious play on One Hit Wonders. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an effort to expose, the plot is an effort to expose how that band would form, become popular, what they would do along the way. But like we said, it doesn't have a lot of, there's obstacles and there's conflict, but it doesn't really drive the story, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what is driving the story is actually positive notes, which is kind of different than some of the other movies that we've talked about on this show. But everything is going towards the characters for most of the movie. I mean, it falls apart near the end, but you know, it's
not the movie doesn't fall apart at the end. The band, yeah.
Yeah, the band falls apart at the end. But I mean, it's kind of based on this idea of what if you became a one-hit wonder? And you know, which is kind of obvious to say, but it's that makes it enjoyable. You know, I've dreamed of what would happen if I became a one-hit wonder as a drummer, like the person, or as something else. But
it's not too late, Logan. It's not too late.
Well, we'll see. Hopefully it'll be more like a two-hit wonder or a perennial wonder, but you know. But yeah, it's just, it's almost like a fantasy in that way, that these guys who are just, you know, playing out of the garage to start the movie, they become, you know, the band. Do they ever talk about any other bands in the movie?
I'm not sure. I think they meet the other bands as they go, when they become part of the tour, they meet and they're, oh, I love you and I love this band and stuff. But yeah, it's not like they have, you're right, they don't have deep musical influences. They don't talk about, I wish we sounded more like the Doors or the Beatles or something like that.
No, and it seems, you know, a lot of people will take this movie to be, or a lot of people when making this movie might turn it into, this is what music production is like, and this is how it's terrible, or this is how it's predatory, or this is how it's fleeting. But I don't think that's even, any of those are really the focus of the movie. The focus of the movie is these guys, you know, they had a really good hit song and they became stars.
Well, and I think it does delve into the characters. I mean, there's the Tom Hanks character. We'll talk about him later on. He kind of summarizes it at the end. There's the talented music writer. There's the talented musician. There's the clown. There's the one guy who only wants to become in the army. There's the quote unquote, the girlfriend who, and her character becomes thankfully more fleshed out, and they meet other sort of characters along the way. But and I think that's one thing I wanted to point out too, is that people don't realize it, but the name of the character, the bass player, is called the bass player. He's never actually given a name. Have you ever noticed that?
No, that's crazy. The other ones have names, don't they?
Yeah, I know. They don't ever call him by name, and they don't call him, hey, bass player, get over here. They just never refer to him. And once in a while, apparently a couple times in the movie, say, where's the bass player? That's all it is.
So yeah, I think that shows. Well, this is supposed to be a bit of a character, you know. It's kind of like a drama, would you even say?
It's
a drama without much drama, I guess. You know, it's about the characters and their relationships. Like you talked about, there's someone who is like, this wasn't my dream to become a one-hit wonder.
Yeah.
My dream was to join the army. And again, bit of spoilers, he does. You know, it's not like he has a radical change of life. He leaves them to go join the army.
Well, it's funny analogy. You know, I used to play some sports back in the day, and I told people that, you know, it's people have said to me, how can a band be together and have success when they hate each other? And I told a friend of mine once, I said, well, you've played in a sports, you've been in a team where you achieve great things, you win a championship, you win some games, and then you don't even like that person. And I think this doesn't really get into the dislike for each other, but it delves into how you can make quote unquote beautiful music together, even if you're not, you know, you're not necessarily spending the rest of your life together, something like that.
Yeah, these people aren't that harmonious, and they don't agree on everything, and they don't have, you know, oh, let's spend all our time with each other. But they're just kind of, it's almost like they're together by happenstance, you know.
Yeah.
We wrote a hit. You know how to play the drums. You know, this guy knows how to play guitar. This guy knows how to play bass.
Yeah, and there's the one part where the one drummer gets injured, so the other drummer comes in.
Our main guy is the drummer in this one, and he wasn't originally in the band. He's, like you said, he's brought in as a substitute. And I think he conflicts with the main guitarist, the talent, a lot.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, you know, these guys happen to write a hit together, and the drummer contributed to it being a hit as well. But, you know.
Yeah, there's a great moment towards the end of the movie, which, you know, at the risk, again, of spoilers, it kind of sums up the movie, where the guitarist, not the singer, the other guitarist, who I would call the clown, I forget the actor's name, he's played by a comedic actor, but he says, they're doing some recording on some Top of the Pop show, and he says, how did we get here? And I remember thinking, yeah, the whole movie kind of subtly puts them together to this place that they were just kids on the street, different jobs, some going to school, and suddenly they're at the Top of the Pops. So,
and I think that was kind of the feeling throughout this whole movie. That's what it was all about, was that these, you know, random Joes off the street become well-loved. And it shows how they respond to that. You know, they're really happy. I think one of them really cares about girls and is all about that.
But you know, that's a good part. How they respond to it isn't necessarily violent. Like in any other movie, there would be someone would delve into drugs, or someone would smash things or get chased by the police, but they never get that far afield. Something?
No, they never become evil. They, you know, sometimes they dislike each other and they do kind of stupid things occasionally, I believe, but it's not like you walk away from the movie being like, oh, I hate that guy, or, you know, as a warning to anyone. If I were to become, I could become any of these characters in the film, and I'd be very happy about it.
So I'm gonna talk about the title song, but before we get to that, one of the reasons why we chose this for that song for that movie is because the title song, once you see the movie, it's hard to think of the name of the movie without starting to sing the song, right? Which we won't inflict upon you. But what's interesting to it, and this is, like we said, this is Tom Hanks, his first or second movie he's directed. He's only directed two or three, I think. What's interesting here is that the song actually isn't fully baked until about 2/3 of the way through the movie. So to me, it's interesting. And like I say, one reason why we highlight it is because at the beginning, they have a slow version of the song. Mm-hmm. And then by mistake, the drummer speeds it up.
I thought that was intentional. But either way, the drummer speeds it up.
And then later on, they meet one of the characters. Their uncle is a musician in a church. And we might all talk a little bit about that later. And then he adds the hand claps. Right. And then later on, they get a different bass player or something like that. But the whole song doesn't become the pop phenomenon, quote unquote, within the context of the movie until about 2/3 of the way through, which kind of reflects to me, I think it's intentionally done, the development of the characters and the development of the band, that they don't become a full-fledged band until after they've actually had a few shows and made a few more recordings.
Yeah, just like the band isn't fully formed and it's not a real pop band, they're just kind of some guys thrown together, the music reflects that. It's not that poppy of a song to start with, but as it goes on, it gets more...
And there'll be people who say, I think you got a hit here. We just need to do that. Now I'm going to introduce you to the studio. They're going to do this part. Okay, now we're going to record the hand clap. So it all kinds of, the layers are, here we go. The layers are added to the song, just like the layers are added to the movie.
There we go.
Yeah, clip write that down. Yeah, did anyone get a pen here? Write that down, yeah.
Yeah, and I think this also helps when watching the movie, because they perform the song, it must be half a dozen times or more.
Yeah. But parts of it.
Yeah, that's the thing. They never, I think there's only once that they perform all of it.
I think so.
And so, you know, if you had to listen to the same song 10 times in the span of 2 hours, even if it's a good song, which this is, and we'll get into that later, you know, even if it's a good song, listening to it that much can get boring. But since it changes and we always get different parts of it, it feels a bit different every time, which, you know, that's really interesting to see it grow.
Yeah, and I think that helps when we do finally hear the whole song fleshed out, played end to end, then the band is in a situation where they're at their peak power. So this is as popular and as great as they're going to be, so therefore we get the whole song.
I wonder, maybe we should have done this before coming on, but I wonder, you could plot how much of the song is played at any time during it. I wonder if it would mirror the whole, you can't see my hands, but I'm mushing it out right now. The, you know, the rise and fall of a story, you know, the initial incident, and it goes up until the climax. And because the climax of the movie really coincides with the full length playing of the song. At least the positive climax,
the peak of their popularity.
Yeah, I don't know if they actually perform it after that, but whatever. My analogy is falling apart. But you know, it kind of, you hear more and more of it as it goes on until, like you said, at the peak.
So I think that's a film studies question. This is for those of you who've, studied Waiting for Godot and Dr. Calgary's Closet. You can map emotional moments to the beats of the song or maybe to the timbre of it. I mean, if you wanted to get carried away, you could make a paper on something like that, maybe a bit beyond our discussion.
Yeah. Another thing that's really important about this song, I think, is that it's a good song. I mean, you listen to it so much during the movie. If this song was annoying or if you didn't like it, then it would be really hard to get to this movie. It would
be difficult to enjoy the band, so...
Yeah, and it's, you know, yeah, we like the band because they have written a good hit. And if this was something like, I'm trying to think of a, you know, Friday by whatever it goes, you know, something that's annoying. Or
something caustic, or like we talked about Nirvana, if it was a depressing, plodding song intentionally, it'd be hard to keep re-listening
to it. Yeah. And so this song had some commercial success outside of the movie too, right?
It was a successful. The soundtrack was a bit of a 60s throwback, although the songs were modern musicians and modern
movie,
production.
Which year was this movie?
Oh boy, 1990, I want to say, something like that. Okay, 1994, okay. Somewhere in there. Yeah.
Yeah, that seems about right. But yeah, it was set a bit in the past to play on some nostalgia too.
So let's play it then now, and people can get a sense of what we're talking about.
Always do, and you don't mean to MRG Live is pleased to present the legendary DJ Shadow live at the Vogue Theater on January 23rd. Don't miss your chance to catch this pioneering producer performing music from his latest release, Action Adventure, alongside his rich three-decade-long catalog, which includes collaborations with artists such as Run the Jewels, Nas, and De La Soul, among others. For tickets, head to admitone.com and search for DJ Shadow.
You're listening to That Song from That Movie on 101.9 FM CITR Radio. So, Mike, what was your favorite part of this movie?
So there's lots of enjoyable parts, I think, but to me, one of the best parts comes at the very beginning, the first time the band hears their song on the radio. And so this is a bit wish fulfillment for the audience, given that people don't, as CITR fans know, people don't listen to radio as much as they did in 1965.
But you guys do, and we love you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we're grateful. We're all grateful for you. But so the moment, that would have been a miraculous moment to hear your song on the radio. So in the context of the movie, again, you know, in the 60s, you have to hope radio station plays it, and no 8-tracks, no cassettes, no streaming, you know, for those of you of a certain age.
Yeah, you know, nowadays I can upload my song on Spotify and listen to it right then or something, you know.
So
it's not that direct back then.
So the scene does a good job of illustrating that, because the members of the band and their quote-unquote girlfriend, Liv Tyler, they have a listening to the radio everywhere they are, in the appliance store, on a little earbud, on AM radio,
during their work, I think, in
the car. They're listening to every radio station they can, or I think it's set in this small town, Vicksburg, and something like that. Yeah. It's a small town, yeah.
But a small town, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, hoping their song gets played, and when it does get played, they all gather together, and the excitement of it, hearing something. I mean, to me, it has several aspects of it. Number one, you're hearing your art being enjoyed by somebody, in theory. Number two, this is the path to making money if you get on the radio, as, you know, Logan and I have deeply hoped for our session here. Yeah. And then the third part is just that is a recognition of that, yes, we must be valid as an artist because we're being played on a public radio station.
Yeah, it's kind of the first step of their journey to legitimacy. You know, they had played in front of an audience before and they liked it. But, you know, like you said, they have to turn that. This is where they start turning it into something of a career, where they're like, we can contend with other songs. We can actually do this, I guess.
Yeah, we can achieve success, and we're good at this. I don't know if there's a lot of other parts in the movie where they recognize it. Like, parts that they play on stage in front of, you know, 1,000 fans, and they start to go, wow, we must be doing really well. But it's not as though this is a Rosebud kind of moment where we're only, for those fans of Citizen Kane, that we're kind of focusing on only the initial song. There's other parts where they're enjoying performing, right?
Yeah, but I don't think it's ever as acute as it is for this. I mean, everything else, maybe there's one other step between, you know, after hearing it on the radio. But this is kind of like, you know, like we said, this is you realizing you can make it. Everything else is a difference in quantity, and you're more popular and you're more popular. But this is, you know, this is a difference in kind. Yeah. Your song is no longer just something that you'll play occasionally at venues. Your song is actually something, you know, that you can make money on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it legitimizes it. Yeah.
In the beginning, there was Thumb.
Something strange and funky condensing out of the primordial ooze. Then, underground house parties and backyard raves, stuff of legends still whispered about in Los Angeles. And now, the space barn blasts off, and Thumpasaurus is ready to engage a new frontier in the Thumpiverse. Don't miss Thumpasaurus live at the Biltmore Cabaret, January 18th, presented by MRG Live. Head to admitone.com to get your tickets now.
You're listening to Movie Maverick Mike and Logan the Extra on CITR 101.9 FM. I want to talk about the cast a little bit. Is it time to talk about the cast now?
It's time to talk about the cast.
Okay. Well, wow, that was good timing. So what's interesting about the casting is that, first off, Tom Hanks gives him, as director and producer, gives himself a plum role as Mr. White, which is, I would call, a producer of the band.
Yeah.
And he helps them get on tour and pushes them into the studio. And then he also gives his wife, Rita Wilson, as a cameo as a waitress in a jazz bar, a Los Angeles bar that the drummer goes to.
Yeah, again, it's a cameo, so it's not much of a part.
But the four players of the band, the actors, I'll just read it out here. Tom Everett Scott is Guy Patterson, the drummer, and like Logan said, the main character. Jonathan Skatch is Jimmy, the songwriter, and Liv Tyler's character, his boyfriend. Her character, Faye Dolan, is the mistress, not the mistress, the seamstress.
Yeah, the seamstress. I'm sorry, seamstress thinking of, for the band.
Yeah, thank you, the Elton John. Steve Zant, who's a bit of a comedian, plays Lenny, the guitarist. Ethan Embry plays, as we noted before, the bass player. So of the four members of the band, none of them, you can say, have gone on to wild stardom.
Yeah, if you couldn't tell by Mike's kind of sight reading, not the best pronunciations. I shouldn't say that.
Ethan Embry, I got
your pronunciations were good, but you know, you can tell that these aren't familiar household names.
Yeah, rule off the tongue.
Even for us movie connoisseurs, you know.
So what's interesting, and again, you know, this kudos to Hanks as a casting director, is that the secondary players, the supporting actors and actresses. So first off, Liv Tyler, who was a bit of a star at the time. But, I mean, she's only gotten to be more popular, mm-hmm. plays Faye Dolan, and she gets caught into a love triangle. Giovanni Ribisi, he's been in a lot of movies. He usually plays a slimy kind of Weasley character. He's a small one here. And perhaps his most famous role is Southridge on the Avatar movies. Do you remember
right,
that?
Right, right.
Yeah, so again, back to the Weasley part. Charlize Theron has a very small role as Tina, one of the characters... vain girlfriends at the beginning. So this was before Charlize Theron became the A-list actress that she is. And then I alluded to the uncle, Uncle Bob, who helped them record in the church for their thing, is played by Chris Isaak, who is a successful Grammy Award-winning, I think Grammy Award-winning, or was MTV Award-winning musician at the time, has a small role. So all the small roles are covered by people that you could look them up and go, oh, I know that person, that actress, that musician. But the main roles have kind of drifted.
Yeah, it's a bit of a reverse from your average movie where usually the main cast is stacked and it's A-listers and, you know, as many popular names as you can find. And the others, they're like, ah, we'll just get anyone to film this small part. But yeah, Tom Hanks, I don't know why particularly, but he got a lot of, well, I'm assuming he worked hand-in-hand with the casting director to get a lot of people who weren't that well known, and I guess still aren't well known, but you could have known that to get the main roles.
I mean, this movie wasn't that popular of a movie, not when it was released and not in retrospect. It got a bump because of the 60s soundtrack that was beloved and, you know, a modern production of 60s type music. It also was, what's the saying, big in Japan. So the four actors decided to do, because of promotion, Tom Hanks and the studio said, we're going to fly you over to Japan to play as if you were part of this band. And
under the name of the Wonders.
Yeah. Then. And what's funny about it was most of them said, I'm not really a musician. I just pretend to drum. I mean, I can fake it. So apparently a lot of them spent time
learning their instruments.
Yeah, because they only had to play a few chords to look good on the movie. And then they said, okay, now we're actually playing it in front of our Japanese fans. We have to really prove here.
Yeah, that's really odd. I mean, the other day on the show, we covered Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And that was a bit of an anomaly because they taught the cast how to play their instruments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas most movies, they don't care. And, you know, none of them would know how to play guitar or do anything.
Well, and what we said earlier, that they don't spend a lot of time on their musicianship. So there's not a lot of scenes of them in the studio drumming things out, practicing their lines or something like that. Yeah, they only play the one song.
Yeah.
But they do play some other songs. One other one, I can't remember that they play.
I don't remember the names.
But they do have the occasional song. But yeah, that's the same one over and over. That's part of the movie, that they play the same song over and over, like you said.
Yeah, and there's a couple times where they talk about being musicians and they're like trying to record in studio and stuff. But yeah, I mean, you know, as long as you could learn 2.5 chords and you can look like you play guitar and smack the drums around the bit, you know, it's not, you don't actually need to know it. So yeah, I'm surprised they took them for a tour.
And that was the extent of their popularity. As far as I know, they never toured in the States. There's never talk about getting back together. I haven't heard anything about a sequel. I mean, Tom Hanks can do what he wanted in Hollywood, so if he wanted to make another one, he could. But, you know, it kind of ended where it did.
Yeah, maybe if this was a more popular movie, we'd be seeing That Thing You Do too. But
That Thing You Keep Doing. Keep yeah, doing that thing you did. I know what That Thing You Did is last summer.
Yeah, something like that.
Are you a writer?
Listener?
Dreamer?
Music nerd?
Want to cover artists?
Visit venues?
Write something?
Events?
Personal essays?
Anything!
Submit to Discorder magazine and then take it a step further on Hail Discordia with your hosts, Zoe
and Izzy. Hail Discordia is an audio translation of Discorder magazine. We interview writers, play music and soundscapes, and do a deep dive of each zine issue. Hail Discordia plays at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the third Thursday of every month on CITR 101.9 FM.
Submit something for the magazine and come onto the show, or just tune in and listen. We promise it's worth it.
You've been listening to That Song from That Movie on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Movie Maverick Mike, and you can find me under that name on Facebook and Instagram.
I'm Logan the Extra, and you can find a recording of this episode and all of our episodes on CITR.ca. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you later.